Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Parrott and Luganville against Taylor. Brown, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. In my argument today, I will address the petitioners, Mr. Robert Parrott and Mr. Francis Luganville, as the defendants. I will refer to Mr. Taylor as the plaintiff. These are the positions they originally occupied in this action. As a bit of factual background, in April of 1975, the plaintiff was housed in a penal institution in the state of Nebraska, of which Mr. Parrott was the warden, and Mr. Luganville was the supervisor of the hobby counter, which is a internal organism which provides hobby goods for inmates at that institution. The plaintiff ordered hobby material while he was a prisoner. Money was deducted from his inmate account to pay the vendor for those goods. Before the goods arrived, the plaintiff violated a disciplinary rule and was placed in disciplinary segregation. When the hobby materials arrived, the plaintiff was still in disciplinary segregation and was not entitled to have them at that point in time. The material were signed into the institution by Mr. Costos and a Mr. Garrow as a part of their clerical duties at the hobby counter, and the material was held at the hobby counter for the plaintiff. In June of 1975...
You say as a part of their clerical duties. Doesn't your opposition claim that that was against prison regulations?
They do, and I...
Do you agree?
Do I agree that it was against prison regulations? No, I do not. I think if you look at the answers to the interrogatories filed by Defendant Parrott and Defendant Luganville, they indicate that those signatures were affixed as part of their clerical duties. I admit this poses some problems at this point in time, particularly in view of the fact that this case was resolved against us on a motion for summary judgment. But in our opinion, there does appear to be some question with regard to that particular aspect of the case. In June of 1975, the plaintiff was released from disciplinary segregation, requested that the hobby materials be provided him. A search was made for them, and they could not be found. On October of 1975, the plaintiff filed his first complaint with the U.S. District Court, and the District Court did not file the complaint and instructed him to return and seek a remedy with the Department of Correctional Services. In November of 1975, the plaintiff filed a second complaint. This complaint was filed but dismissed prior to issuance of summons on the grounds that it was frivolous. In March of 1976, a third complaint was filed and summons was issued. In April of 1977, counsel was appointed. In June of 1978, the plaintiff filed his motion for summary judgment. And in October of 78, a judgment was granted the plaintiff against these defendants. The plaintiff, during this entire course of conduct, never filed a claim under the Nebraska Tort Claims Act for return of the value of these materials, which it is unquestioned were lost at the institution. I would like to address two questions which are raised by our brief today in oral argument. First of all, whether the existence of a state-created remedy for property loss caused by the negligence of state employees provides adequate legal process under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. Second, would like to discuss whether simple negligence in the context of a property loss case can create personal liability under Section 1983. Mr. Justice Douglas in Monroe v. Pape set out three basic purposes for the enactment of Section 1983. Number one was to override unconstitutional state laws. Number two was to provide a remedy where state laws were inadequate. Number three was to provide a remedy where an adequate state law was not, in fact, available to a plaintiff. None of these goals are furthered by imposing liability on these defendants. There is no state law question presented, and it is no showing on this record that an adequate state remedy is not, in fact, available to a plaintiff under these circumstances.
Would your argument change if the inmate said, you've lost my property, and the answer is, yes, we have. We did it negligently, but we lost it. And he says, well, aren't you going to either replace it or pay me for it? And they say, no, absolutely not. Do I have any remedy? Not that we know of.
If that were the case, then I think what you've got is a problem of denying the inmate, if in fact that was within the power of the people, denying
no
the inmate
longer,
access to his remedy.
Yeah, it's no longer just a piece of negligence, is it?
No, I think you have to characterize the case entirely different. You're one way of, it would be similar to, at that point, infringing on that inmate's right to access to the courts.
Well, suppose Texas law just hasn't got any, there isn't any, or Nebraska law, just is, there isn't any law, There isn't any remedy, internal remedy, under the state law. The prison officials are perfectly correct. There just isn't any remedy as far as we know of, and we're not going to pay you, and we're not going to replace the property.
But that's no longer negligence. That's a willful deprivation of his property, isn't
exactly.
it?
Well, exactly.
Well, I think
that's what it either, they either are going to give him a remedy, or it's going to be that, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, but I think the thing that you would, I guess I would urge that type of situation be evaluated in the context not so much of imposing personal liability on these persons. If you have a person administering an institution and he by his personal participation, but certainly property is lost on occasion in these institutions. I don't know that you have a situation where the inmate comes to him and says, I want to be paid, you lost my property. And the warden says, in this case, yes, I know we lost your property. I know the institution lost your property. I personally will not pay you. And the institution does not have the authority to pay you. It seems to me at that point you have a substantial grounds for some interpretation in a declaratory or injunctive sense as to whether or not the inmate has been denied by the absence of a state remedy due process with respect to that.
You wouldn't be making the same argument here. If that had happened, you wouldn't be making, what would you think about a 1983 action on those very facts that you just?
On those facts, I would move directly to my second argument regarding the basis of the negligence. But it does seem
well,
to...
Well, why? It isn't negligence any longer. They just say, we're not going to pay you. We've lost your property, but we're not going to replace it, or we aren't going to pay you. And as far as we know, you haven't got any remedy.
Even though we concede that we wrongfully deprived you of it. That is, deprived you of it through our negligence.
I guess I've lost the trail
well,
here.
Well, I'm just suggesting it is no longer just a negligence question.
No, I think that's correct. I think you have.
Well, then it wouldn't do you any good to move on to your second argument.
Well, if you've got the problem of what is protected, and I think you have to look at this in the context, it seems to me, of personal liability, and just what exactly the authority of these defendants is with respect to repayment of these types of losses. Our position basically is that the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, does not prohibit property deprivations. It only requires that a legal process be available when deprivations occur. It is the process and not the property which is constitutionally protected and constitutionally significant.
Mr. Brown, I'm not clear on your position with respect to whether or not there is a process in Nebraska.
Our position is
that they failed to make a claim under the Nebraska Claims Act, and then you said the burden is on them to demonstrate the absence of a Claims Act, I guess. Well, what is your position on this, whether or not there is a state remedy?
Our position is that a state remedy exists, and that if the plaintiff is to make out a case that he has been denied property without due process of law, he not only needs to show that he has lost his property, but that by some mechanism he has been denied due process of law, that that loss has occurred to him without some type of adequate process, whatever process might be found to be due him under those circumstances.
Well, is it, as a matter of fact, I guess you tell, you can, you should be the expert on what Nebraska law is. Is there a state procedure by which he could recover the monetary equivalent of the value of this hobby?
The Nebraska State Tort Claims Act regularly considers and regularly pays where deemed appropriate claims for property lost, property damaged, this type of thing of the inmates of our state institutions.
I see.
And the inmate has to bring an action in court?
The inmate initially files a claim with the State Tort Claims Board. That claim is administratively reviewed. The claim at that point is either the department against whom is heard, and then if the inmate is not satisfied with the result of that, he may appeal that directly to our district court.
And that is, but that is an appeal rather than a trial, de novo?
Well, the trial would go de novo. There's no record created in front of the board. This
so
is
it's
simply
not just a review.
An administrative consideration of whether the
first, and then there's an administrative consideration first, and then if the inmate loses, he goes to court as a plaintiff.
That's correct.
And it's not a reviewing court.
No.
It's a trial court.
No, it's just the administrative review is simply
a necessary condition precedent.
Jurisdictional step to get to the district court.
What does he have to prove in the administrative review?
At the administrative level, I think simply he would indicate that the circumstances under which his property was lost, and the Department of Correctional Services would have the option, in this case, of coming forward and providing their side of the story. Quite frankly, in this case, I don't see that the department would have ever taken the position, and very often they do not, that there was no reason not to compensate this man for his loss. The difficulty arises to a certain extent in that our claims board is the only board funded in the state of Nebraska to pay this type of claim. The Department of Correctional Services is not funded. These are considered unappropriated expenses, and therefore the mechanism of the claims board is involved.
Now, Mr. Brown, if he loses and has to go to district court, number one, does he get a jury trial?
I don't believe he does, no.
And what does he have to prove in district court to recover?
In district court, he would have to prove that there was negligence on the part of the state of Nebraska, or one of the employees of the state of Nebraska. Simple negligence would suffice at that stage of the proceedings.
And I suppose recips loquitur would not be far away, would it? I mean, the very fact it was lost, it was sent to him and lost.
Right. Under these facts, I don't anticipate that there would ever have been a dispute on that. Our dispute is with regard to the proper forum to seek the redress,
right,
and not with regard to Mr. Taylor's entitlement to reimbursement.
Right. And would negligence be the issue in the administrative proceeding as well?
Actually, their authority there is even broader than that. There wouldn't even have to be.
They could give him money without.
If they felt that there was some inequity involved, even less than negligence, they certainly would have the authority to reimburse him at that point in time.
What constitutional deprivation was alleged in this case?
It was claimed that he was denied his property without due process of law.
Contrary to the obligation of the state not to take his property without compensating him? Is that it?
I would
guess.
Well,
I mean, is that the way you understand it?
That's my understanding of it, yes.
There was, in effect, an eminent domain case rather than a denial of due process?
They are different.
Well, I guess in my evaluation of this, we aren't talking about an eminent domain case because that is where the element of intent comes in.
That's right.
And under these circumstances, where there is no intentional taking, there's certainly no opportunity to provide this man a pre-loss process, whatever would be termed to be appropriate in that case, as in an eminent domain case where you could go in and establish the value before the property is taken. That opportunity simply isn't presented unless you have at least, I would guess, at least a reckless or a wanton and willful. You can argue in that span whether or not there's some intellectual functioning.
But your answer to his claim consistently has been, and it still is here, that there is no denial of due process as long as the state has a suitable procedure to compensate him.
That's correct.
So you're really saying that as long as we go compensate him or replace it, there's been no denial of due process.
That's our position.
And that would be true whether the claim were a deprivation of property without due process of law or a taking of property without compensation.
That's correct.
But here he seeks also $1,000 damages and also $1,000 punitive damages.
That's correct.
Which he couldn't get in the claims court.
No, he could not get that in the claims court. I guess our position would be, it seems to us under a 1983 analysis, those damages run as a result of the constitutional violation. And we are saying we never reached that threshold.
That somebody deprived somebody of $23 and you fine him $2,000 for
that is problem. From a practical standpoint, that's one of our serious concerns. Even if, as the Eighth Circuit, what contact I had with them, their concern was, why simply didn't we settle this case? Why didn't we get it out of their hair? Our position is, even if we took the position, or if we are finally informed that this type of thing does establish a constitutional violation, we are still faced with a substantial burden. If one of these cases is filed in the district court and we immediately go in and say, yes, we lost the property, we now understand that that constitutes a violation of the 14th Amendment, we're going to have 1988 hanging over our head. And every $23 case is going to cost us $200 or $300 or $400 if we get there 5 minutes after the filing hits the table. This, from a practical standpoint, not from a legal standpoint, poses a substantial problem for the state. And that is one of the underlying problems that we urge here. I don't think it's a basis for making the decision, but it certainly is a practical problem that we are faced with from the position of prison administration.
I take it, Mr. Brown, there are no provision for fees under the state claimant procedure. That's the difference, then.
Basically, it proceeds simply as any other tort, state tort remedy.
Right.
Well, then now, as a practical matter, unless he can get a free legal representation, he's not going to bring a lawsuit. Not even going to bring an administrative proceeding, because the fee would be more than $22.
Well, I take it they proceed pro se normally on a proceeding.
He certainly has the opportunity to proceed pro se.
But may I ask about the adequacy? You're saying that's an adequate procedure, basically. Two or three years ago, we had a case involving the procedure that must be followed in shutting off electricity when the billing procedure is bad by a utility. And the court held, in effect, you had to advise the person of his rights in order to have the process adequate. Is there any procedure for advising the inmates as to the existence of this procedure?
At the present time there, where I think if you look at the record, if you look at Exhibit B on the plaintiff's complaint, it indicates that at least in January of 1976, that he was aware of this state procedure. Now, I do not know, and the record does not indicate how he came to be aware, but the second exhibit to his complaint is, I need the numbers on my checks so I can file my state claim. Apparently, he was aware of it. Now, why at that point, having been provided that information, he did not go forward and file the claim, that's an answer I don't have. But and I do know from my personal contact with the system in the last 2 years when I've worked with it, that they are regularly informed that if they have a problem like this, this is the manner in which they can seek redress, is to proceed through that type of mechanism.
General Brown, does Nebraska still have the common law of torts practiced in your court?
I believe they do, yes.
Would a common law tort action have lain against the individuals alleged to have been responsible for this loss rather than against the state?
I guess that would be another portion of our argument. And on these particular facts, I have some serious questions as to whether liability could have been established under a basic tort theory. But
suppose one of the prison guards, for example, had an automobile accident resulting from his negligence when he was taken a prisoner to and from a court for a hearing. Could the prisoner sue the guard in Nebraska under common law tort doctrine?
I guess...
Why not?
I don't have a specific response.
Could you bring a damage suit if you were riding in my automobile and by gross negligence I caused an accident? We can in Virginia. Can't you do that in Nebraska?
I would assume so.
Well, what would the difference be? The prisoner is riding in a prison vehicle to court, and the driver, by gross negligence, has an accident that results in injury to the prisoner. Couldn't he bring a tort action under state law?
I guess the
against,
thought that I have...
Against the driver, what's the difference between you and the prisoner in those circumstances?
The difference, I suspect, basically, between the driver, between a correctional officer operating that vehicle, is more practical than legal. Though I'm not certain whether I can answer your question or not, because I have some concern as to whether or not the tort claim procedure might forestall that type of action against someone functioning as a state employee. I'm simply not certain on that. But...
You think as a matter of state law, it's possible that the injured party might be relegated to the administrative proceeding?
I think I simply don't have an answer, but I guess from a state defense standpoint, that would be an issue I would certainly want to look into before I could give you a definite answer on that.
One remedy or the other.
Yeah.
There may be an election also. I simply...
But he has some kind of remedy. You would concede that.
Certainly. He's not forestalled from any remedy
to
whatsoever.
To compensate him for his personal injuries.
Right. Moving on to the negligence question, we think it must be viewed in the narrow context of this case, and that is whether Section 1983 prohibits the unintentional deprivation of property by persons acting under color of state law, and whether such acts would create personal liability. We do not believe that the language of Section 1983, the cases of this Court interpreting Section 1983, or the logic, purpose, and public policy of that act support liability in this instance. There is no evidence that these defendants directly caused or personally participated in the loss of this property. Rizzo versus Good rejected liability without an affirmative participation by the defendants, even in an equitable action. And I think we have to realize that the burden of proof, what needs to be proved to obtain equitable or injunctive release or declaratory relief under this act, is not as stringent as what should be or what has been imposed to obtain personal liability.
Parrott was the superintendent of the correctional facility?
Yeah, chief executive officer, technically the warden of that particular institution. Justice Blackmun in Baker versus McCollum said that reckless failure to stop a pattern of clearly unconstitutional conduct by subordinates could be enjoined under Section 1983. But in that case, there was no evidence that the defendants knew that there was a problem and that liability was then rejected. We think we have a similar situation here. There's no indication on this record that there was a general failure with the system. And there's no question as to whether these men particularly participated in it. So I think we've got a problem there.
Mr. Taylor. Mr. Brown, I beg your pardon. If a prison guard stole an article of personal property from an inmate, what remedy would he have?
What remedy would the inmate have?
Yes. a guard had stolen an item of personal property from the inmate's cell. Let's say he took, if you allow transistor radios, that he took his radio or took three books or whatever, stole them.
Well, I think, first of all, what you have is an entirely different case than you have here, because what you're dealing with is an intentional act.
Right.
And it's not our position that that type of act implicates the same problems we see with negligence.
Well, does Nebraska have an action for conversion, or the equivalent of the old common law conversion? Well, wouldn't that be a remedy against the...
I would think it would be. Not to mention, this wouldn't aid the... would not necessarily aid the inmate, but certainly we would, I think that would fall under our criminal laws as well. But we aren't talking about a situation where
be conceding that, in my brother Powell's example, that would be a constitutional deprivation?
I'm basically saying that it presents a much closer case because we're dealing with an intentional act.
Right.
And I guess I'm not...
Why is it a closer case under your first argument? I don't think it is. You'd still say there's this remedy in the claims procedure.
That's correct under the first argument, but I guess our position is that our second argument could form an independent basis, even in the absence, because certainly not all states have established the types of procedures we're talking about here.
But your second argument seems to be to blend two different thoughts. You, on the one hand, seem to be arguing, well, they really don't have any proof of negligence, and alternatively, you seem to be arguing even if there were negligence, that 1983 would not provide a remedy. I'm not quite sure whether you're arguing both. I think you are.
Well, okay, we're under these facts, I think, a placed in a rather awkward position. Our position basically is that even if there was proof of negligence, that it does not constitute a violation of Section 1983. What we have argued in our brief is that we don't even believe on this record there is evidence of negligence, but I think those are two distinct questions, too. If the court would permit me,
you're prepared to assume negligence for your 1983 argument.
For those purposes, yes. I'd like, if I could, to reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Colleran.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm court-appointed counsel for the respondent in this case, excuse me, Burke Taylor, Jr. The respondent cannot concur with the statement of facts as given this morning by the Attorney General's office. I am somewhat shocked to find at this late date that the Attorney General's office is now taking the position that the conduct involved was not in violation of the regulations of the institution. I think that they concede as much in their brief. The facts in this case, I think, can be broken.
What difference would it make for the purposes of your case if you point that out?
The facts, Your Honor?
Yes.
If they weren't in violation?
If it wasn't intentional.
Well, I think, first of all, there is some evidence of intent, but aside from that, I think there was an established institutional procedure which they violated, and I suspect that if there had been no institutional procedures and if they had simply left Mr. Taylor's property to the whim or whoever grabbed it when it came to the institution, that there would be no difference. But I'm just saying that I think the facts are different than as related by the Attorney General's office this morning, and they're considerably different. I think the Attorney General represented as I stated, I think that they can be broken into three different categories, the first being the institutional procedure that was in effect at all times pertinent here too, and this was set forth in the stipulated facts of the grievance supervisor or officer prepared by the Attorney General's office at his suggestion at a hearing on a motion for default judgment in this particular case filed on behalf of the respondent for their failure to answer interrogatories. And the grievance procedure was, as stipulated to, that normal procedure when a package is received at the institution addressed to an inmate at the central mailroom, it is either that the package is delivered to the inmate cell where he signs the package receipt, or the inmate is notified to pick the package up at the hobby center and to personally receipt for it. And then it goes on to say that deviations from this practice are only made in exceptional circumstances, and there is no record of there being any exceptional circumstance in this case. which seems to me to be an entirely different case, and that is represented to the court this morning by the Attorney General's office.
It's an exceptional circumstance because he was in isolation.
Well, there again, Your Honor, the Attorney General office has fabricated something out of the record. There is nothing in the record to indicate that he was in deadlock or anything else. He was transferred to the Adjustment Center. The reason he was transferred there is not in the record, and I know for a fact because I happen to be, I've represented Mr. Taylor since 1973 in this and other litigation, that Mr. Taylor spent time in the Adjustment Center at his own choosing from time to time because he felt the need to be in the Adjustment Center for security reasons. There's nothing, absolutely nothing in the record that would indicate that he was there because of a disciplinary problem.
It didn't matter why, but the fact that he was in the Adjustment Center would be an unusual circumstance and probably explains why he wasn't available to sign for the package.
I don't think so, Your Honor, not on the facts of this case, because the facts of this case, the supervisors indicated that the fact that he was in the Adjustment Center was not an exceptional circumstance and did not justify the conduct in this case.
Well, I think the in the present posture of the case, at least, we can assume negligence.
All right.
On the part of the defendants.
And I think there
was.
At least
for the purpose of the first two issues that have been the only issues argued here.
Okay.
Can we assume negligence on a when it goes off on a motion for summary judgment?
Yes, I think we can, Judge. I think that, Your Honor, in this particular case particularly, I think that we have a situation where the property comes to the institution after he has paid for it and ordered it in accordance with institutional procedures. It is taken into custody when it comes to the mailroom to be examined, and when he goes to get the property later on, it's not there. And the reason that it's not there is because the institutional procedures were violated. And the reason that the institutional procedures were violated are set forth in the answers to interrogatories filed on October 12th of 1976 by the warden and by the supervisor of the Hobby Center. And where they say they set forth an institutional procedure that is totally foreign to what actually was going or should have been going on out there.
Well, now we're arguing about whether or not there was or was not negligence, as
yes,
in for quite properly in response to my brother Rehnquist's question. But it seemed to me that the Attorney General's first two arguments that he made orally here, the only two that he made orally, both assumed negligence. Now, in his brief, there also is contested whether the question of whether or not there was or was not negligence, but I don't believe we took this case to decide that.
All right. Well, I didn't understand the Attorney General's office to be that. I thought he was saying, in effect, that they were in conformance with institutional procedures and therefore were not negligent. But assuming, if we can assume at least some negligence, and I think that the conduct on the behalf of the petitioners goes far further than just simple negligence, if we can categorize it, I think that to suggest in this particular case that Mr. Taylor should have proceeded under the State Tort Claims Act in Nebraska, frankly, I find a little bit shocking. Mr. Taylor was represented by himself from the time that he first filed this claim until mid-April of 1977.
I thought you said you represented him since 1970-something.
On another matter, Your Honor, I did not represent him in this particular case until I was appointed in April of 1977.
He had retained you?
No. I was court appointed in that case as well.
He said you kept talking to him.
He had a particular fondness.
Every time he would go to this separate place.
Well, I'm going to get to that right
well,
now,
I
Your
mean
Honor.
That I don't say you can say absolutely that he didn't have counsel.
I'm saying that I represented Mr. Taylor on an earlier action at the institution. I was not appointed and was totally unaware of this case until April of 1977,
but
2 years after the taking of his property.
But he knew how to get in touch with you, didn't he?
No, he did not. Not about this matter. He never did.
Then you want to withdraw your statement that you represented him since 1970-something?
No, I do not want to withdraw my. I was simply pointing out, Your Honor, that I represented him since 1973, and I was aware of the fact that he was sent to the Adjustment Center for reasons other than disciplinary reasons in response to an inquiry by Justice Stevens.
During the same time that this incident occurred.
Yes, but I was totally unaware of it, is what I'm saying. I was not advised of it until April of 1977, and when I was appointed by the court to represent him in this case. That's the first time I had knowledge that he had lost his property out there. See, he had been transferred to the state of Arizona. He was serving time in other institutions other than the state of Nebraska. So I did not have day-to-day, week-to-week, or even month-to-month contact with him. But what I'm saying is that at the time I was appointed, there's a 2-year statute of limitations under the Nebraska Tort Claims Act.
Before you get to the time you're appointed, if I may, because we got diverted a little bit in
sure.
response to my question about the Nebraska claims form. You said he was not represented, and it's kind of fanciful to assume that he'd know about the procedure. Your opponent has called our attention to Exhibit B, which is dated January 8, 1976, in which he specifically makes reference to information he needs for filing the small claims form.
Correct. That's an entirely different procedure than the Nebraska Tort Claims Act. There's also a small claims court in the state of Nebraska, and he tried to pursue the small claims court, which is the county court and the municipal court for the city of Lincoln. I tried to track down records, and it's not a part of this record, but I tried to pursue this, and there is no record either in the municipal court or the county court over there, but that is an entirely different proceeding than the State Tort Claims Act, which provides that he must first proceed under the administrative provisions of the Act. So, and to
why
suggest...
Why did he do that? Is it that he, are you suggesting that the inmates don't know there is such a remedy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear.
Why did he not do that? Does the record tell us anything about that?
Why he did not pursue the Tort Claims Act?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me if he can get $32 back by filing an administrative proceeding, surely that's better and more desirable than coming all the way up here.
Well,
if not for him, at least for a lot of other people.
Well, I think that there are several deficiencies with the Nebraska Tort Claims Act, some of which have been alluded to by this Court today. The first, of course, is that there is no right to a trial by jury.
Well, but do you need a trial by jury in this matter?
Well, but the Attorney General...
I'm talking about this specific case. What is there to explain to us if there, in fact, is the remedy that your opponent has represented exists? Well, how is it that he wouldn't pursue it? Is it just the fact there's no fees available for counsel?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think, first of all, that he did try to proceed the grievance procedures out at the institution and was denied those, and I sort of assumed that he was... I can't speak for him, but I assume he's probably getting a little frustrated with the system, and he thought he could get relief in federal court. But there is no provision for attorney's fees, and there is no provision for the appointment of counsel, which means in every instance for Mr. Taylor and those similarly situated, he's going to be going it alone against the considerable resources of the state of Nebraska.
Well, Mr. Collin, what about someone who is not a prisoner, but who suffers a $25 loss at the hands of the state? Could he proceed pro se in the small claims court in Lincoln against the state official to get for a judgment of $25?
Yes, I think he could, Your Honor.
He wouldn't necessarily have to sue the state either, would he? He just sues the official.
Well, I think he could sue. Well, he sued the officials in this particular case.
Well,
as well.
Do you think you could collect from the? Did you sue them in their official capacity?
We sued them both individually and in their official
capacity. So there isn't any, do you suppose you could get a judge, if you could, suppose this case had gone to trial and you get a judgment against the officials, and can you collect it from individually?
I think that, you mean under the small claims court?
Yes.
I assume that we could execute. In this case, however, he was denied any relief under the small claims court.
I understand that, yeah.
Was he, in fact, denied relief in the small claims court?
Yes, according to me, and again, this is not part of the record, but in talking with Mr. Taylor by long-distance phone, he told me he was summarily dismissed out. He tried it twice, in fact.
Is that in the record?
No, it is not.
But it is in the record that the attorney fee was $792.54.
That was granted, that was stipulated to by the Attorney General's office. And that, I would like to also indicate that we did not seek punitive damages in this case of $1,000. We abandoned that claim. The only thing we were seeking was our compensatory damages in the amount of $23.50.
It is in the complaint.
It is in the complaint, but we did not, we abandoned that.
But you didn't abandon the $792?
No, I did not, Your Honor. I think that under the Civil Rights Act, I'm entitled to an attorney's, the prevailing party is entitled
which
to attorney's fees,
which
we could not get. And I think that is a very important provision of this act because, again, Mr. Taylor would have been forced to proceed pro se under the State Tort Claims Act.
Well, but if he only got the $25 back. Oh, yeah.
Pardon?
That's all he got was $25, right?
If he'd been successful, yes, that's correct.
Well, this judgment, that's all he got. He got the same thing he would have gotten through the administrative machinery.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, what else did he get?
I don't know that the administrative procedure would have provided him anything at all. It is administered by
the
Attorney General's office.
It could have given him.
Well, a theoretical remedy is possible.
Well, haven't some people won 20? Do you think they're in trouble to pick up $25?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The only difference between what he could have gotten under the administrative machinery, and what he did get here was zero. Is that correct?
Well, that's a considerable difference, I think, to my client.
Zero? He didn't get anything more.
I'm afraid I don't understand Your Honor's question.
Well, the answer is that the only additional money obtained in this action, as contrasted to what he could have gotten in the other action, was counsel fees. That's my question.
Oh, I see. Well, yes, I think that's probably correct. But again, you know, this court has held, I think, since Monroe versus Pape, that Section 1983 is supposedly to be in addition to states to state remedy that a state might have provided. And I don't think that we can assume on this record that the Administrative Procedures Act of the Tort Claims Act would have been available or a successful remedy to him. It is a theoretical remedy, much the same as was discussed in Monroe and in a line of cases since that time. And I think to suggest, if we take Mr. Taylor and say, all right, for a 14th Amendment case, you have to go under the State Tort Claims Act, we're putting everybody under the State Tort Claims Act, and it seems to me the end of Section 1983 for 14th Amendment cases.
In 14th Amendment, negligently caused property damage cases. Because the converse of that, I suppose, is every automobile accident involving a state employee is a 1983 claim where you're guaranteed attorney's fees.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, not at all. I think I think that the thrust of Section 1983, the color state law provision, is the misuse of power. And simply because we have an automobile accident involving a state employee does not mean that there has been misuse of power.
Well, there's been, but you stick rather closely to the language of the Constitution. There's been a deprivation of property without due process of law causing an injury to the plaintiff.
Well, that's correct for the 14th Amendment. For Section 1983, it requires a misuse of state power. And I'm saying that while he may have been deprived of a constitutional right, it may be only a common law tort as opposed to giving him accessibility to Section 1983.
Is your claim based on negligence?
I think it is based upon the fact. It is based upon the fact. More than
yes, yes or no. Yes
my
or
claim
no.
is based well on yes or no answer. I don't know that it's possible.
Well, why not?
Pardon, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, my claim is based upon a very high degree of negligence, Your Honor.
Well, high degree. It's negligence.
Yes, it is.
Then what's the difference between that and a state truck that's racing down the street at 70 miles an hour? That's a high degree of negligence, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Doesn't that bring it within Justice Stevens' question?
I think that first of all, with that given set of facts, embellish the facts a little bit. I think
I gather your position is that 1983 requires both a violation of the Constitution and a violation under color of state law.
That is correct.
And you say here there's a violation under color of state law because of the participation of the warden and the hobby manager.
That is correct.
Whereas in the automobile accident case, you can't prove
misuse
under color of state law.
That's correct. There's no just given me, there's no way that I can say that there's been a misuse of state power.
Well, but why do you equate misuse of state power with under color of state law? Under color of state law simply means that the person was employed by the state or acting for purposes of the state, doesn't it?
Well, as I understand Section 1983, Section 1983, one of the purposes for its creation was the misuse of state power. And it seems to me the distinguishing feature here in this particular case is we have the warden, who is a chief administrative official of the institution, and we have the individual who is charged with the responsibility of protecting the respondent's property taken into custody. And they are, in effect, violating an affirmative duty placed upon them by the institution itself.
But what's
by
that
ignoring
got to do, really, with whether or not there's a constitutional violation? And there couldn't be a constitutional violation in this case unless the state or its agencies were the defendants.
Yes.
Because the Constitution prohibits only a state depriving somebody of property without due process of law.
That's
or
correct.
Taking somebody's property without compensation. It doesn't prohibit a private party from doing so.
I agree. Maybe I didn't understand the thrust of Justice Rehnquist's question.
I still think he doesn't understand.
Where in this litigation was the talk of the existence of the State Tort Claims Act raised?
It was raised for the first time at the application for rehearing in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this, as I started to say before, was approximate. That was a year ago this time. which means that it was 3 years after the statute of limitations had run on the respondent in this claim.
This lawsuit really hasn't been tried, has it? It went off in summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is the existence of the State Tort Claims Act an affirmative defense on the part of the defendants?
Well, I don't know that it is under the Nebraska law an affirmative defense, but the Attorney General's office is charged with the administration of processing the Tort Claims Act, and it seems to me that for the year and some 6 months that they had notice of this claim, Mr. Taylor having been claiming that he had been deprived of a constitutional right, that they could have either raised that in their pleadings or have told him in some other communication that they felt that he was in the wrong court under the wrong law.
Well, it certainly was not raised in the pleadings.
It certainly was not raised in the pleadings. It was not raised at any time in the trial court. It was not raised at any time on their brief. In the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, it was raised for the first time in their application for review.
I'm merely asking whether we aren't spinning our wheels with all this talk about the State Tort Claims Act in the posture of the case as it is before us.
Well,
I should direct this to your opponent, not to you.
Yes, that's correct. I guess it's our position, Justice Blackmun, that at this point in time, it does seem to me that the state, having raised it for the first time in its application for rehearing, it's a little bit tardy. The statute of limitations is run on Mr. Taylor now. There's a 2-year statute of limitations which expired, as I indicated before, prior to the time that I was appointed counsel in this case.
Suppose that there had been ample notice to him from the very outset about the tort claims procedure, and he just ignored it.
Well, I think that under the state of the law in 1975, and as I understand the law even today, that was his choice of forum. He has an allegation of a federally protected or constitutional right he thinks he's been deprived of. And
yes, but the argument on the other side is not that this is that exhaustion of administrative remedies is required. It's a question of whether there can be a violation of the due process clause for depriving somebody of property if you stand ready to pay him for it. And if there is that procedure in place, and if he knew about it, if they had given him ample notice of it, and he just ignored it.
Well, they didn't give him ample notice, and to the extent that he was aware of the procedures, the grievance procedures at the institution, he did pursue those and got nowhere.
Why isn't the same principle applicable with respect to the small claims court proceeding, as in responding to Justice White's question? He said he needed something to file in small claims court. There apparently was no obstacle to his filing there. You say he wouldn't have gotten wouldn't have had a lawyer there, but most small claims courts operate with no lawyer on either side, as I understand.
That is correct, and that is true in Nebraska as well, Your Honor. And I'm just saying that in this case, and the only thing I know about his Small Claims Act application is mentioned in the tag end of his complaint. And he said that he tried it and was dismissed summarily out twice. And I attempted to run down the records, but they had no trace of them. So I really don't know what went on in small claims court.
You didn't file his complaint?
In the small claims court?
No. Here?
No, I did not. It was a pro se complaint filed in some year and a half before.
He doesn't automatically get a lawyer in the 1983 pro se action.
That's correct.
Mr. Holleran, may I put this hypothetical to you? Let's assume that a state tax department, through negligence in the operation of its computer, for example, failed to make a refund that was due a taxpayer, say, for 2 or 3 years, and finally it came to the taxpayer's attention. Would that case be analogous to this one, so that there'd be a constitutional violation justifying a 1983 lawsuit?
Let's see, if I understand your question, if the computer malfunctions and the taxpayer is deprived of some of his tax dollars.
He doesn't get his money for 2 or 3 years, whatever the time. He doesn't get it when it's due. Well, let's assume, to make the case perhaps easier for you, that negligence is alleged, and if whoever was in charge of the computer had known exactly how to manage it the way it should have been managed, that error would not have been made.
Well, I think that in that, under those circumstances, and with the perhaps with the situation with the racing state car, there would be the entitlement of some qualified immunities, and if these qualified immunities were
but
pled,
before you come to immunity, you have to have liability. Would there have been liability under 1983, a suit against the individual, personally and officially?
If the individual, I guess I'd have to say I don't know. I think that if there had been a, had that been negligent, can't.
Would it be any easier for you if you eliminated the computer and some clerk had simply made a mathematical error, a stupid mathematical error, negligently, that resulted in the delay in the payment of a just refund?
I think that if the individual established the deprivation of a constitutional right and that it was...
Well, you're assuming the answer when you say that.
That is correct. Well, and I'm not certain what the deprivation would be in the particular
Do you think that's significantly and clearly different from your case?
I think it is. I think that here the individual ordered the property in accordance with institutional procedures, relied upon those procedures, and was denied that property when it got to the institution.
If you're entitled to money, that's not a deprivation of property if it's withheld from you?
Well, I assume, yes, I think it is. I think it would be a deprivation. And assuming that there were some procedural violations and there were allegations of negligence, then that may well set forth the Section 1983 action.
Mr. Collin, you say Mr. Parrott was liable. Conceitedly, he had nothing to do with the misdelivery or stealing or whatever it was of the packages, but because he was warden and was responsible for the administration of the institution, I take it.
No, I think that there's more involvement on the warden's part than that, Your Honor. I think that, as I noted earlier, he was charged with the responsibility of administering this procedure, and he was administering a procedure that was worse than no procedure at all. He testified under oath in his answers to interrogatories that he felt the institutional procedure was that anyone who happened to be around, in effect, to receipt for an inmate's property could do so. And it seems to me this placed him in a position where he could not supervise those under his control. He could not correct the incorrect application of the institutional procedures. And he could not supervise the respondent or the petitioner Luggenberg, who was charged directly with the control and custody of the property.
What if his answer had been to this interrogatory? We have a perfectly satisfactory system in our manual. I can't be there every day seeing what comes in from the mail delivery. I rely on other people to do it. Do you think you still could hold him liable for money damages?
I think that if he made the institutional procedures available to those charged with the direct administration of this and saw to it that they got those procedures and perhaps instructed them that they should be read and they should be thoroughly familiar with, then there would be a more tenuous connection with the warden in this case.
How about the governor of Nebraska who appoints the warden?
Well, I don't think that the governor is, I think that in this particular state, the warden is under a direct statutory duty to administrate the institutional procedures.
So at least on the basis of respondeat superior, you think, if you're correct in your basic substantive claims, that he's a proper party defendant?
Well, I guess I think it's more than respondeat superior.
Well, I know, but at least on that basis.
Yes, yes. But I think, again, I think
I know you think in this case it is.
Yes, yes. I guess in summing up, I would say that, and I recognize that this court in Rizzo has held that respondeat superior is not viable under Section 1983, but again, I think in this case there is that more than that involved. I think that, again, I think Mr. Taylor has been deprived of a constitutional right. The property.
What is the constitutional right?
The right to his property.
Is it just the right to his property, period?
No, I think that that he was deprived of it without due process of law as
and then
well.
Do you have to allege the absence of due process? Justice Blackmun suggested it was an affirmative defense. I wonder, isn't perhaps the issue who has the burden of, of telling us whether or not there is an adequate state remedy.
Well, I suspect that if that burden properly belongs upon the state of Nebraska.
Well, why? If it's up to you, if the constitutional violation is not just the deprivation of property, but the deprivation of property without due process of law, perhaps one could argue that you have the burden of demonstrating an absence of available process.
Well, I think that in reading Section 1983 and the cases that have...
We're talking about the constitutional violation now.
Right. I'm sorry. In reading Monroe and the cases that have followed, I don't think that there's ever been any intimation that the State Tort Claims Act was a substitute for...
I thought your claim was that the very taking of his property without charging him with anything, without a hearing, without notice, was itself a deprivation of his property without due process of law.
Absolutely. That is our position.
Well, where did the damages come in? About $5,000.
The wrongful taking of his property.
It's a case of conversion boiled down to its simplest. They took property that belonged to him into their custody.
Now,
and when he came...
Is it conversion? Is it taking without due process? What is it?
Well, I think in this particular case, it's a taking without due process.
That's all you allege.
Okay.
What if an inmate had taken it rather than it disappearing through the way it did?
Well, I think then that if an inmate, you mean, has simply gone in his cell or something and taken it? Well, I don't know then the state in that instance would be responsible, or the warden, or the supervisor, just given those set of facts.
Why not? Doesn't the state have an obligation to watch the property of the inmates? Wouldn't that be as valid a negligence theory as you've alleged here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think there's an important difference in simply property disappearing out of a cell and in a place where an individual orders property through the United States mails in reliance upon an institutional procedure that he will be able to take that property into custody when it gets there. And he orders that property and pays for it and relies upon it, and then finds when he gets out the property has disappeared, and it's disappeared because institutional procedures haven't been followed. Which, as again I stated earlier, this was worse than no procedure at all, because Mr. Taylor was left in the position where he thought there was an institutional procedure to protect his property. He finds out that not only is the institutional procedure not being followed, but there is one that has been placed into effect by the warden in the custody of the hobby center that is worse than no policy at all.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. You have about 5 minutes remaining, counsel. Brown, you may resume.
Your Honor, first of all, I would like to point out again, since it came up in Mr. Collarin's argument, we do not look to the existence of the tort claims remedy as an affirmative defense. Our view is that the existence of that remedy or some similar remedy, in fact, provides the process due under the 14th Amendment. Therefore, if it is absent in any form, it's something that the plaintiff, although he may not need to allege it specifically under Gomez, he certainly wouldn't have the burden of proving that as part of his prima facie case. Second of all, with regard to the use or abuse of state power, it seems to me on this record the only use of state power here was the establishment of the bailment of that property when it came into the institution, and the loss of it I don't think necessarily involves an abusive process in any respect.
Well, didn't Monroe against Price say that 1983 is available, whether something is legitimate under state law or illegitimate under state law?
I guess I don't understand.
Well, I thought that's what that case held, and I thought that's what accounted for the multiplicity of 1983 suits that followed in its wake. That so long as the defendant is a state officer is what it comes down to. And it's no defense to show that it was either legitimate or illegitimate under state law.
No, what I'm saying is that
So there doesn't need to be an abuse of state power.
I would think for liability there does have to be some showing of an abuse of the power of the state. Our position would be that that showing is necessary to impose liability.
What you mean is abuse of a power amounting to a violation of the Constitution, don't you?
Yes.
An abuse by way of negligence does not violate the Constitution, is that it?
Yes, we're saying that this is a threshold question and simply that negligence, at least with respect to the context of a property loss, negligent property loss simply does not cross the threshold of a constitutional violation. Therefore, it becomes, in essence, then, a part of the plaintiff's case.
What if the property had been worth, instead of $23.50, $100,000?
I would make no distinction.
Is it your position the Tort Claims Act is what takes care of that?
I think our position as we briefed it and is today that the Tort Claims Act provides that type of remedy. I think as came out here, also our small claims remedy may. Due process being as flexible a concept as this Court has pointed it out to be, I think any one of these remedies might be evaluated as providing the process.
In your brief, you make a de minimis argument, and that argument wouldn't be available to you if the property were $100,000.
I made that argument because I know that certain of the district courts have employed that argument. I felt it was obligatory on us to raise it. Quite frankly, I don't have any personal belief in the strength of that argument. With regard to any factual dispute, I would simply point out that under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56, the Court was obliged when granting summary judgment to review all of the pleadings on file and just ask the Court to review them again. And finally, I would like to say that with regard to the question of negligence and whether simple negligence itself forms a cause of action under 1983, that I think the interest shown by amicus on behalf of the petitioners here, along with the petitioners themselves, indicates a strong desire for some guidance from this Court on that question. And I would ask the Court, if possible, to provide us some sense of where we stand on that question. Finally, I think that if the penal systems of this country are to improve, and I think we all desire that they do, we'll need qualified, intelligent, and reasonable people to run them. And I think we have to be careful not to make penal administration a legal jungle that just has so much potential for liability that actually no reasonable person would want to work in that area.
Could the state of Nebraska, within its constitution and the federal constitution, just abolish its hobby program totally?
I would suspect this would be one of the potentials we would have to evaluate administratively, whether or not we want to carry on that type of activity, if, in fact, our administrators are going to be held personally liable for the loss of this type of material.
Indicating there are a lot of losses, or certainly you wouldn't reevaluate because of a $23 loss? Would you?
We wouldn't want to reevaluate, but certainly it would have to play a part in our thinking with regard to any material we allow to be introduced into the institution that is not constitutionally mandated. I'm simply saying that would have to be weighed in our consideration.
Would I be correct in assuming that you've already done something to correct somebody from stealing people's property?
Well, we thought we had a system at that time, Your Honor. That system has basically been continued.
Well, my final question is, why didn't you tell this man that he could get his remedy by the Claims Act?
My understanding is that he was informed. I was not personally involved at that point in time.
It's true there's $23.50 involved here, but is it reasonable to assume that a good many thousands of dollars have been expended in professional time, printing costs, legal proceedings?
It's very reasonable to assume.
Could I ask you if you think the Court of Appeals was given an adequate opportunity to consider your suggestion that there was a procedure available to have this property paid for?
Mr. Collin is right in the fact that that issue was initially raised in our motion for rehearing, but I think as it relates to such a basic issue that they did have an opportunity to consider it, and certainly we don't have any indication that they did.
But is there anything in the record to indicate that this man was aware of the possibilities of this procedure within the time limits that the procedure requires?
Well, I would point out to the court, first of all, well, let me answer your question. With the exception of the Exhibit B, which I referred to earlier, which may or may not relate to the state claims now or to the state tort claims, whether it relates to our small claims, I don't know that that is distinguished.
That was only when the complaint was filed.
Right. My understanding is that's the only thing in the record that would indicate his awareness of the situation one way or the other. I would point out to the court, however, that under Section 81.8.227 paren 2 of the Nebraska Act, it also provides for a waiver of the statute of limitations under the Claims Act if, in fact, the claimant has initially gone to an improper forum. Now, that is couched in terms of a state forum, but I think, as I pointed out earlier, the state might take a lenient view of that that situation in the case of proceeding to a federal.
Well, does the record show what the conversation was when he found out his property was lost? Did he ever ask people to replace it or to pay for it?
The record, and I'll grant you, the record in this case is very scanty. The record, as I would understand it, indicates that he contacted Mr. Reibolt, who is one of the three parties whose sworn material is before the court, who was the grievance officer, to look into the matter, and that searches were made to see if the material could be found.
But otherwise, the state just shrugged its shoulders? They prison people? They didn't purport to suggest that they would pay for it or replace it?
There simply is no showing on this record as to what happened, and I question the propriety of really informing you beyond that,
yes,
because first of all, I was not personally involved in it.
Yes, all right. Thank
and
you.
I think we ought to stick to what is on the record. But again, it seems to me you have the question of where the burden falls as to inform. Apparently, from the record, Mr. Taylor was aware that some remedy was available to him. Beyond that, quite frankly, the record is not very elaborate.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.